The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Cool, let's just do it one more time.
Why?
Because we love making movies!
Hey everybody, I'm Aaron Jellabolo and welcome to my podcast, Because We Love Making Movies. Today we have a special episode. We're not only talking about a documentary film, but also a film that was shot by two different cinematographers. That film is The Social Dilemma. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival to a roaring response. It was released on Netflix and recently received 7 Emmy nominations. So I'd like to welcome the two artists who make me think of those sunglasses of truth in John Carpenter's sci-fi horror film, They Live. For those of you who haven't seen that film, when you put on those sunglasses, you see that all media are the subliminal messages of horrifying aliens who you can also see through those sunglasses. In this instance, these artist cameras are showing us the terrifying truth about the business of social media. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome John Behrens and Jonathan Pope. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Hey, Aaron. Thank you.
Thank you. So guys, I just wanted to start with, and I guess, John, I'll start with you and then Jonathan, respectively. I wanted to just how did you guys become cinematographers? How did you find your way down the path to becoming not only a filmmaker, but also a cinematographer?
For me, I don't think I had any choice in the matter. I think I was drawn to science and light and technical stuff from a very, very young age. We were on a vacation and my dad handed me his Super 8 camera when I was 9 years old. He's like, here's 4 rolls of film, make a film, beginning, middle, end, credits, the whole thing. Didn't tell me much else than that, but I figured it out. And I made my first film, including stop motion. Of course, I didn't realize you had to put the camera on the tripod to do stop motion. So it's a little shaky. But I started when I was 9 and... Wow. Shooting Super 8 film. Got my hands on my first video camera when I was 12 at the shopping mall. There was a place parents could drop their kids off and there was a video camera there and I just played with it there. When I was about 12 years old, I got into a community theater as well. So I started doing a lot of community theater, both as an actor, technical stuff. Then I started lighting design and I did about 6 seasons of lighting design all through high school. And wow. Also in high school, started making movies with my buddy and my friend Francois Chu, who was a brilliant, he was 2 years younger than all the rest of the kids in high school. And he was just a genius. And the two of us made films all through high school. And we figured it out. We would watch a movie, we'd watch the behind the scenes, and then we'd figure out how to do it ourselves. And we were in that, our genre was action adventure. So we were blowing stuff up and trying to do sci-fi with cardboard boxes and gels that we got from the theater and, you know, just whatever we could pull off. They were all terrible, but we made about 14 short films through high school.
Wow.
Just continued on in. I did a little bit of rock and roll touring. So I learned about large scale logistics. I toured the world with Michael Jackson in 96 and 97, just on the crew. And I was like, okay, this is how you do something really, really big with lots and lots of cameras and lots of scale. And so that added to the pile of knowledge. I started doing narrative film around that same time and did narrative up through probably the early 2000s to mid 2000s, and then sort of got into documentary around that time and have been really focusing on documentary feature films from 2007 on.
Wow.
And done a lot of commercials in the meantime, commercials, music videos, corporate stuff. And, you know, every once in a while I get to go back and do live music stuff, which I still love. Like all the cameras live, one time, get it right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess back up a little bit, what were some of those early films, action adventure films that you guys were inspired by when you were a kid?
We loved all the James Bond genre. We loved the early Batman film. The first Tim Burton Batman film was the...
It's amazing. Amazing.
The mood and the music. Like, also, we realized how music was such a part of how you tell a story.
Yeah, Danny Elfman for sure. Yeah, crazy.
I think we made like 3 films with Danny Elfman soundtrack music. And,
right.
And and my friend was a musician. He was a violinist, and his sister played piano. So we were making our own music as well. I think the comedy side was Monty Python, but I think visually, Arnold Schwarzenegger films, like Total Recall, sci-fi stuff. 2000.
Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven. And of course, all the, 2001 was also a mind-blowing film. All the Kubrick stuff. That's when I learned how a film should look from my perspective. It was so, so clean and perfect. And I'm still trying to get there.
I think it was definitely the Kubrick. It was like Strangelove and 2001 and those kind of movies. And even Paths of Glory, where you realize, you go, wow, this is shot in a way that is making me feel a certain way. I mean, it really was. And I remember making an early short film to my DP. I said, hey, can we get, those pools of light like they get in, Dr. Strangelove? And he was like, let me explain to you how they do that. They had a stage at Pine, at Pinewood or what, and you realized how hard it was to get what those guys got. But it's so inspiring. And so just one last question on that front. Did you go to film school or did you just learn by doing and then just start working?
Well, I'm dyslexic, so school has always been hard. And I was lucky enough to get, I made a film called Stunt Boy, which got a lot of attention. It was a little short film that was the behind the scenes making of a stunt for a fake film, a fictitious film called Brindisi Summer, starring Harrison Ford. And the film I made was the making of the stunt. And it was a kid who was played by my friend Francois. And he, so it's a big crash, behind the scenes. And we got the cops and the fire department and all that, little cameos. It's all found footage cut together with stuff we shot. And I got that into the hands of the general manager at ILM at the time, Scott Ross.
Wow.
And he invited me and my buddy to ILM to show our film at Monthlies in front of all of our heroes at the time, Ken Ralston, Dennis Muir, and Steve Williams, Spaz. And then he was like our college coach. He was like, so what do you want to do, John? And I said, I wanted to be a cinematographer. And he's like, well, you got to go to USC or UCLA. and if your grades aren't good enough, then maybe you can go to a community college and transfer in. I tried that route. I tried community college first. I was bored to tears. So then I transferred to San Francisco State, which had a decent film program. Uh-huh. And I started working on films that same year. And I was real movies. So I was actually working. I had a gaffer that was a mentor of mine. His name was John Fontana. And he started bringing me on sets. And I started working at the same time as I was going to school. And I just couldn't do both. And I was so much more moved by what I was learning from being on set that I just kind of let it all go in the final semester because I was working 12-hour days, 3 days a week on a feature and then trying to go to school. And I let the reins go at that point and just dropped into full time into the industry in 1994. And I never finished college, and I figured it was up to me to learn everything that I was going to learn in the field. And I had wonderful mentors over the years. If it wasn't for my many mentors, John Fontana is a gaffer, a guy named David Lazinski, who was a sound guy and a video engineer who taught me about the electronic side of cinema. I can't list them all, but I had many mentors. They were my film school and the work.
Nice.
The work itself.
Yeah. It's fantastic. That's amazing. It's almost like a much more old school version of the apprenticeship, which used to happen much more in Hollywood, And Jonathan, did you, how did you find your way into filmmaking?
Yeah. So I didn't come from a filmmaking family. My mom has a love for photography, but both of my parents have always worked corporate jobs. But So I'm not entirely sure where that itch came from, but my parents always like to say that I knew how to put a VHS tape in the player before I knew how to walk. So there's something there from a very, very, very early age. And as a kid, I loved painting. I loved drawing. And I was very ahead of a lot of kids in that respect. You know, I played sports, but I think my way of expressing myself is always through some sort of physical art form. And again, not coming from any sort of filmmaking background, I had no bearing on what it even took to make a film. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we had an old, one of those old chunky VHS mm-hmm. Camcorders. And I would take that and I would take my like Star Wars toys, my Power Ranger toys, and I would just film little like vignettes and little action sequences. And sometimes I wouldn't even use the cameras and I would just like squint my eyes and try to frame up things and play around and make stories. And then when I got into high school, I decided to join the theater program there because I thought maybe I wanted to be an actor. I thought mm-hmm. that might be a path for me. Because again, at the time, I didn't even know what a cinematographer was. Right. So I did theater all throughout high school. But as a hobby, after school, I took on editing. I taught myself how to edit. So I'd pull, footage from movies I liked or music videos or video games or whatever. And I would splice them together into music videos or into, little trailers and things like that. And that was kind of how I learned rhythm and kind of taught myself without really knowing what the terminology was about shots and mm-hmm. composition and things like mm-hmm. that. But I hit a point where I was kind of tired of messing with someone else's stuff. I wanted to be the one making what I was seeing. And so in college, I doubled down on filmmaking. I went to a small school called Georgia Southern University in Statesboro, Georgia. We didn't have a filmmaking program at the time. We had a film minor. So I started as a broadcasting major, basically, news, mm-hmm. news reporting. Mm-hmm. But I took as many of the film electives as I could. I became really close with the film professor there, Joe Bastorak, and another professor there, Melanie Stone, who's a now really close friend of mine. And they really fostered that interest for me. I delved into it as much as I could. I also met one of my best friends there, James Kicklider, who's also a director I still work with to this day, also lives out here in Los Angeles. And so we kind of paired up and went and shot as much as we could. We did a documentary all about the golden age. Well, I guess now you basically, kind of be like a narrative podcast, but at the time it was like radio theater.
Oh.
So we did a documentary all about that. We interviewed some of the greats from that time. Because it was a smaller program, I knew that there was still more to learn. Mm-hmm. Drawing near graduation, I kind of hit this point where I was like, well, I'm going to go one of two ways. I'm either going to go out in the industry and just do it and just try to see where that takes mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. or I'm going to apply to USC. And if I don't get in, I'll go out and graduate. What I really wanted was to get into USC. I really wanted some sort of structure because I think I really thrived on that environment and some guidance. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I applied to USC and got in. And I was, kind of flabbergasted because I didn't feel like anything that I had done was worthy of me being admitted.
Right.
But, they saw something in me. So in 2010, I moved out to Los Angeles to attend USC's film school. By that point, I knew that cinematography was the path for me. I just had such a deep love for it. And so I doubled down on that. It was funny because I remember at the start of USC, we had all of our year in the theater there, in the Norris Theater. And I forget who was up front, but they asked, everyone raise your hand if you want to be a sound designer. And like only, maybe one or two people raise your hand. Raise your hand if you want to be a cinematographer. And it's like, I raise my hand. Raise your hand if you want to be a director. And the majority of the
right,
room
of course.
Raised their hands, because starting out, I think most people think that that's the way they want to go.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Lo and behold, everyone kind of found their paths, found their individual passions. But from the very beginning, I knew it was cinematography for me.
And just out of curiosity, to interrupt you quickly, do you think that was when you were making that documentary, that first documentary, where you really kind of were, it sounds like that was kind of one of the first, you know, big projects that you tackled as a filmmaker and a cinematographer. Did you find that holding the camera, you know, in close proximity to a subject kind of gave you this connection that you said, wow, this is what it's all about, you know, to a certain degree?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was the first, I mean, college was the first time I was really able to put a name on what it was. You know, going back to being a kid and playing with those action figures, I think I was always drawn to cinematography. I just never knew what it was.
Right,
I was just kind of instinctively doing that kind of work. At USC, I really doubled down on it. I worked with some wonderful cinematographers there that I still stay in touch with. My mentor, Christopher Komen, who's an ASC member. Earl Rath was a great professor of mine. Angelo Pacifici, those were my cinematography professors. And I also kind of met my cohort there. Those are the people that I work with most often. I say 95% of the things that I do somehow are tied back to USC in some way. I mean, they call it like the USC mafia, which it's a very real thing.
No, that's for sure. For sure.
It is. So after graduating, I just started working. I tried to get on as many sets as I could, mostly as DP, but every now and then I would gaff or camera operate, you know, commercials, music videos, did a lot of music videos, short films, and then eventually started getting more and more into longer form content. So now I've done, I think, 6 features now, both narrative and documentary. But I feel like my heart kind of is in both places. I love taking what I've learned from kind of the instinctive nature of documentary and bringing it over into the narrative world. So I kind of straddle the line, but mostly most of my work has been in the narrative side of things.
And I think they really do feed each other. It's like one of my favorite DPs of all time is Roger Deakins. And he talks endlessly about his experience as a documentarian in terms of A, his relationship with the camera and operating to the subject, but also sort of where you put the camera so that you can sort of capture the scene in the best. It's almost like documentary kind of prepares you for, okay, where do we put the camera? Where's the, if we only have one place to put it, right? I feel like documentary, you have to, because if you don't, you don't even have a film. You know what I mean?
And documentary has come so, you know, so far from what it used to be, but it, you know, at its essence, it is so stripped down and you are just working with the bare essentials, right? You have a camera and a subject and sometimes lighting if you're lucky. And you just have to find your frame and find your light with whatever's there. And I think that, that's a really valuable tool to bring over into narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think is actually why I started. Keep going. But I think it's actually why I think my personal way of working, I actually like working with less gear. I don't find it constricting. I find it creatively freeing. I think sometimes there's such a thing as having too many tools and too many bells and whistles, and you just kind of get lost in the excess.
Yes. I agree with that
entirely. I feel like that, less is more sometimes. Constraints are sometimes your best friend.
Absolutely. And it's interesting too about this film, because I feel like you guys really are threading this, or walking along a little bit of a knife's edge with, you know, sort of the pure documentary format woven in with this narrative feature that's sort of under, you know, organically part of the documentary. And so for those who haven't seen the film, and everybody really should. So The Social Dilemma is on its face a documentary that interviews, you know, key players who are sort of almost like recovering social media experts who have a perspective on developing the business of social media and their opinions and thoughts on how it has become very much a harmful force in our society. And then alongside that, almost in between, you have a narrative feature which is almost a separate movie. It's sort of a movie within the documentary that is sort of showing you the things that are being spoken about by the interviewees. And I think it's pretty unique. I'm not sure it's ever been done before. I have to say it reminds me very much. I feel like it's a kindred spirit to Errol Morris's The Thin Blue Line, because, and I say that because obviously he does recreations, and I've heard both of you say in other interviews that this was not a recreation, which it certainly isn't. But what I love about The Thin Blue Line is those quote unquote recreations he does, they're actually kind of just impressions. They're like little weird abstract films. They're not like trying to show you exactly what happened, but it's more of an impression of what you've heard about. So I just felt like the film is so artful, you know, the work that you guys did, and everybody should see this movie. And I just wanted to start, I guess, because John, you started on the film in terms of shooting the documentary portion of it. And can you just talk about how you met the writer-director, Jeff, and how you came to the project?
Yeah, I was at Sundance in 2015 with another film called Racing Extinction. And the producer of that, Olivia Hernan, introduced me to Jeff. Actually, we were in the car on the way to a screening, and Jeff Orlovsky got in the car, and I very briefly met him, and I was a huge fan of his film Chasing Ice, and I think he was making Chasing Coral at the time, if I remember correctly. And we met briefly, and then, you know, 3 years, 4 years later, I get a call, would I come and have a meeting about this upcoming film? And I had no idea what it was going to be. I thought it would be another environmental film, but when they said that it was a Silicon Valley based film that was looking behind the tech world, it was really intriguing to me. And when Jeff and I re-met, and producer partner Larissa Rhodes, I met the both of them, and we immediately hit it off, and we immediately grooved on the ideas behind what they were trying to do visually with this film. Yeah, it was like it was sort of like you meet someone and you're like, oh, well, we've always, you know, you immediately groove. It's like, you know.
And how fully baked was the idea when you met Jeff in terms of, you know, we're going to do this thing called The Social Dilemma, and this is, and was there a structure to it? Because I feel like for people who don't know, documentary is kind of this interesting blend of, you sort of have to be the most free, and then you also have to be the most prepared, you know, like, you know what I mean? So like where was it when you came to it, and how did you work in terms of developing? Was there a script? I mean, was there an outline, like in terms of the subjects? I'm just so curious.
The like most other documentaries that I have shot, they started out in a very exploratory way. We're starting with interview subjects, primarily their sort of entree was Tristan Harris and the Center for Humane Technologies group. And there was six or seven of the members of that group that all came from the tech world in various different ways that are, like you said, sort of reformed tech industry folks. Yes. And those were our first key interviews. But Jeff had also was coming to the table with a very strong visual idea of what he wanted. And he loved Errol Morris's stuff. So you absolutely keyed into that. What's the most recent film that he did?
Wormwood.
Wormwood.
No, which is a blend of a strange narrative.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's like a series. It's like, it was so strange. No one saw it, but it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So Jeff mentioned Wormwood as an inspiration. He liked a lot of the notes that they were hitting with these interviews. He was even asking me, like, how did they pull this off? How did you have so many cameras? How did you not see all those cameras? You know, he just was liking how engaging those interviews were looking. And so it's always nice to be inspired yet not be copying. And so we wanted to create something that was different, so that had a different vibe to it, that picked up a lot of the notes of the surveillance aspects of sort of looking in on this industry that's actually looking in on you. So we were kind of trying to create this, you know, surveillance capitalism. We were trying to create surveillance of surveillance capitalism. He liked the, Jeff liked the, we started immediately exploring locations. and we looked at, we looked at sort of like a sci-fi looking houses and locations, but then we considered empty, disused offices, empty, you know, an office where they'd ripped all the cubicles out. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It was just a giant floor of a building where all you see is wires coming out of the floor and the ceiling tiles gone. Like a tech company had been there. And then mm-hmm, he sort of mm-hmm. liked a little grittier, darker, more sort of tech startup basement was kind of the vibe. Huh. And so we built a set for that first series of interviews with exactly that design in mind. Concrete, wow. Basement, tech startup, sort of the clean lines, like, you know, you take an industrial warehouse, clean all the industry out of it and make it into an office. And that's kind uh-huh. of what that first series of interviews was shot on a set that we lit to look and feel like that.
Wow. And I guess also let's talk a little bit about your sort of choice of lenses and, you know, not to go so down the tech, you know, but what I love about the movie is that it also embraces, particularly at least in the documentary section, is this expressive cinema, subjective cinema, which is people speaking to the camera or, you know, where you're sort of really trying, you know, there's the subject is speaking to the audience. And I think it has a really distinct effect, something you can only do in cinema, you know? So I guess just talk about some of the choices in terms of, you know, how you guys were going to actually film the interviews in terms of working with them and, you know,
Yeah, when Jeff first mentioned he is thinking of between 6 and 8 cameras for these interviews, like 6 to 8 cameras per interview, single subject. I was both, you know, just like blown away and also just super excited. I'm like, all right, that sounds hard. Let's figure out how to make that great. You know, because some of the early sort of traditional teaching I got is that you can light for multiple cameras, but you're never going to get all the cameras to look as good as the A camera that mm-hmm. that you're really lighting for. And I set out to break that rule. I immediately set out to say, of course you can do that. Because I had a theater lighting background and I knew that you were lighting with tons of instruments and you were lighting all sorts of areas and you were having to make them all look fantastic and fuse them together. So why couldn't you do that for multiple cameras?
Right.
And so, yeah, we also wanted to break another rule, which is the eye line direct to camera mm-hmm. and the eye line off camera. And usually you do one or the other. Mm-hmm. You either have an Interitron or an eye direct, which is a optical version of the Interitron, which is for those who don't know about the Interitron, it's essentially using a teleprompter from, you know, that would be used in news to show the news reading text on top of the lens with a half silver mirror.
Yeah. It's got the best name ever. It's got
Interitron. Isn't that great? That's an Errol Morris thing.
It is. And for those who haven't seen it, Fog of War, I think, is the movie that he used that.
Debuted it.
Yeah.
So it's essentially putting the face of the director right on the front of the lens via a beam splitter and cameras. And there's an optical version of that, which is essentially a very small plastic periscope with these glass mirrors. So that gets you the ability for the subject to look right into the camera, connect with the interviewer and the director without feeling this self-conscious thing of staring into the lens. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so usually you do that or you do traditional method where you have the director or the interviewer sitting next to the camera and mm-hmm. the subject is connecting with that person and you're kind of looking a little bit more objectively at this person talking about this experience. And Jeff wanted both. And so we did both. We decided to do both at the same time. And we did the into camera using with the A camera with the eye line directly into camera using a high resolution camera. We tested the Sony Venice and the Red Monstro.
Okay.
I love the Sony Venice. It looks fantastic. And the Red Monstro also looked great. So both those cameras, as far as I was concerned, would both have done the job. And so I left it up to Jeff to decide. And he said the Red Monstro at 8K gave us the ability to really push in from a bust to a close-up mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. wouldn't lose resolution for a 4K mm-hmm. finished film. Mm-hmm. So that became our A camera. And from his previous films, he had two Red Dragons, which became, one was on a dolly that moved all the way from the traditional write-off axis all the way to almost a profile. Then we had another Red Dragon shooting a really tight one-eye profile, like a straight profile. And then we had a series of other cameras. Sometimes we had a tight off-axis camera that was like that traditional frame. Mm-hmm. And then we did a series of wides that were really wide, where you would see a lot of the set. Sometimes we wouldn't see the lighting, which became the challenge, is how wide can we possibly get and not see lighting? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we would do one or two wides at the same time. And sometimes we would even move those positions through the interview. So we would be in one place for a half hour and move the wide to a different place in the second part of the interview. But at one time, the biggest interview we had was one of Tristan's interviews where we had eight cameras going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because he's kind of a little bit of sort of the spine of the interview structure to a certain degree.
Yeah.
It feels that way. I mean, it feels like you're getting a lot of the themes of the piece from him. And I guess just to talk about sort of working with the subjects, I mean, what was something that you found interesting that was kind of unexpected about, you know, when you were interviewing all these people? Because a lot of people, I feel like, oh, it's an interview. You know, you just set the camera up and what else is there to do? And, you know, from your perspective as a cinematographer and even with working with your director, I mean, what did you guys sort of find that was sort of very surprising when you were speaking to a lot of these people in terms of, I don't know, what they were giving you and things that happened that you just didn't expect?
With any documentary, you sort of start on this exploratory journey with an idea of what you think you're going to learn. Mm-hmm. And what became apparent very quickly was that the whole concept of tech being designed to be addictive and all of these things about it that are messing with us psychologically, it all goes a lot deeper than I even imagined it would. Mm-hmm. And the way I had felt that I was being manipulated over the years as this technology became more refined and more efficient at doing what it does. Mm-hmm. At manipulating, this technology manipulates, this technology addicts, this technology holds you to it. I was seeing the personalities behind it. The folks that we were speaking to were letting us in on the idea that they planned it to be this way. They went for maximum engagement, which is maximum addiction. And they created AIs that sort of did the sort of it bleeds, it leads thing. It's sort of like, let's get people to watch no matter what, which means it doesn't matter whether what we're showing them is true or not. Let's show them something that will get them to watch another and another and click another. Because and the more I learned about that stuff, the more I realized how manipulated I had been by it and how manipulated all of us were being by it. And so it was like this, I felt relieved because I didn't feel like I was a crazy person that just had a hard time with computers and felt weird when I would interact with Facebook, or felt strange when all of a sudden I was sort of feeling FOMO about all the stuff that everyone else out there was doing that I wasn't doing because my life wasn't going to add up.
Right, and right.
It sort of was like therapy in a way. It was sort of like, no, you're not alone. You are being manipulated just like everyone else. And these folks admitted we were part of the manipulation, and now we're telling you how it works.
Yeah. So that was almost as if it was being discovered while you guys were filming the conversations. That the more they were sort of telling you, you guys were sort of looking at each other going, wow, did he just say that? Did they just say that? This is, I mean, it was almost too much to believe, because it is. I mean, what it really, I love the line, which is the Chiron that says, you know, there's only two industries in the world that call their customers users, you know, drugs and social media. And it's very apt, you know, in terms of basically they're competing for your attention and they're going to do whatever they can to, and somebody else says, you know, when you can't say what the product is, you're the product, which is so insidious. I mean, that's when you hear that, you just go, oh, Jesus. It's like you have to pause the movie, you know, Okay. So I want to jump over to Jonathan for a second, in terms of, now, if I'm correct, you were brought on after the all of the documentary footage was assembled, and that movie was pretty close to being done, or at least I guess maybe watchable. And just talk about how you were brought onto the project and sort of the challenges you faced, because it sounds like it was fairly quick, like you didn't have a whole lot of prep time.
Yeah, exactly. So earlier in 2019, I had shot a horror feature film called Initiation. And I became very close with our first AD, Travis DeSale, and our production manager, Stephanie Sanziano. So later in 2019, they had been brought on to The Social Dilemma. And when they found out that they were, you know, in need of a narrative cinematographer, they recommended me. And from there, it went extreme. It was very quick. I had a call, a FaceTime interview with Jeff, Larissa Rhodes, our producer, and Daniel Wright, our other producer. And they kind of pitched the project to me. I was immediately fascinated, but they wanted to send me the cut that they had just to, you know, make sure I really gelled with it. So what they sent me was essentially, you know, an hour and a half long, fully fleshed out feature film. It had all of the work that John had done, all the interviews cut together, all the B-roll cut together. And they had mapped out specifically where they wanted these, our film within a film, our narrative pieces to be cut in, where exactly they wanted that to go. And in place of that, they had storyboards with temporary voiceover ADR from just some of the crew.
Wow.
So I could really see in that. I mean, that was almost better than reading the script. Sure. I obviously got a script, but that was just so... Yeah. Indicative of how this was going to play and, you know, could it really work? I was so like deeply troubled by what I saw in that cut in the most appropriate way for this film that I just knew I needed to be a part of it. So, I told them, of course I was interested with, and I'd love to do it. So from there, I had about a week of pre-production time before we went into filming. I remember very early on, Jeff told me that he wanted to approach this like, you know, a drama with mystery or thriller elements, something that felt really uneasy. And that was very clear from, you know, John's work in the interviews and from the, you know, temp score that they had and what they sent me, that was really the tone they were going for. But things on the prep side had to move very quickly. As far as the camera conversation went, I knew that they had shot with the Monstro and the Epic as their B and C camera on the interviews. And we weren't gonna have time to do camera tests. There just was no time. So we were like, okay, let's do the Monstro. That was also gonna provide, we also knew ahead of time that there were gonna be a litany of visual effects in this. So we knew on the back end, we'd want as much information to pull from for our VFX house as possible. So the Monstro was an obvious choice. Where my thoughts really came in were more on the lens side of things. And again, we didn't have time to do tests, so I just had to rely on my work experience and my instinct. And because John had shot all of the documentary portions with spherical lenses, my immediate thought was, well, the immediate way to differentiate our narrative from the documentary is go anamorphic, you know, change aspect ratio, give you those, you know, the oval bokeh and those characteristics. Jeff had never shot anamorphic before, but he had always wanted to. So he really liked the idea. And I'd worked with the Cook anamorphic lenses before, and I'd always loved the quality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the quality of Cook in general, but I love the quality of these in particular. So I pitched them to him. He loved the idea. So we decided to shoot on those. And from there, it just was a nonstop moving train. Every day was, we'd go on set, we'd come back, we'd kind of plan for the next day, shot list, plan for the next day, go on set and do it all over again. We tried to prep as much as we could ahead of time, but with the truncated schedule, we were only able to get so far. So it was a lot of playing leapfrog throughout the schedule. But I don't know if John mentioned, but Jeff is also a very accomplished cinematographer. He had shot his previous two films. So he was a wonderful collaborator. He always had ideas, and he was very clear in his vision of what he wanted for this. So that was just a pleasure to work with. And I think it made the circumstances of having to move so quickly so much easier. Because we were so much of the same mind, and we could really cut a lot of the excess conversations, because we were so tied together on that vision. So it was a really wonderful experience.
You know, to build on what Jonathan said, working with Jeff, I have worked with a lot of directors over the years with a variety of backgrounds. I worked with a director named Luisa Hoyas, who was a National Geographic photographer. So he had a very strong visual sense of how he wanted to see frames. Jeff is a wonderfully creative director, and he's a wonderfully collaborative as well. Because he is his own cinematographer and has worked in those constraints that we talked about, he really had a strong visual sense of what he wanted, and was therefore also willing to say, let's take risks. I know how we can do this the safe way. Let's not do this the safe way. Let's push even further outside of any of our comfort zones. And because he had a visual sense, we were able to push on back and forth on each other about and get the best out of it. He upped my game as a cinematographer dramatically, because he pushed and said, that's a great idea. Let's take it further. Mm-hmm. How about if we do this? And those relationships, we are working with a collaborator, a director, a writing partner, another actor, actors working together. Mm-hmm. Any of those collaborations where your creative partner is pushing back and saying, that's great, but how about this? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a director I'm working with right now, Stephanie Suchtig, and she says, that's a great idea. How about a really bad idea? Here's my bad idea.
Right.
And then I'm like, actually, that's not such a bad idea. Let's go down that road.
Right.
And sometimes you get to a great place, and sometimes you're like, no, actually we were headed the right direction. The collaboration and the pushing, the dynamic pushing back and forth is one of the best ways to get the most out of this medium, out of cinema.
Absolutely. I interviewed this wonderful costume designer, Olga Mill, who designed everything from Hereditary to First Reform. So she worked with, you know, Ari Aster and Paul Schrader. And she likes to call it, she's like, the best directors I work with are always open, but decisive. And I thought, oh, that's great.
Absolutely.
I'm going to use that. That's perfect. You know, because it really is. Because it's like, if you don't really want to collaborate with anyone, you might as well go paint a painting, or I don't know, do large format photography. This is not filmmaking. Is, you know, it's like, even Deakins is like, if you're just going to tell me what to shoot, why am I here? You know, you want to be able to bring your ideas and listen to other people, and everybody should be firing off of everybody. I mean, it's, you know, movies are like the circus. It's a family. You know, I think that's one of the best parts about it. So yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, working with a director that has a vision is such a crucial part for me to having a good experience on set. Someone that is so clear in what they want and why they want it. And I think Jeff was, you know, the perfect embodiment of what you were just talking about. He was so decisive in the kinds of things that he wanted, and he knew exactly where that was going to fit in with the messaging of this film, or which interview it might cut in with. But from there, there was a lot of freedom in us being able to play and kind of figure out, okay, well, how do we film that? We know what we're doing and why we're doing it and what the intention of it is, but how are we approaching it? So there's a lot of room to play.
One of the most interesting things about these discussions is relationships is one of the biggest parts of why this is a successful, what makes a successful film or a successful short. Like you said, I love the circus. It's funny. I didn't even know Jonathan had a theater background until now, but we both came from theater, which is another ensemble visual art.
The
reason I had to stay in some part of this was the ensemble part of it. The fact that you are working with a team, it's a social thing. And yet for people that get bored easy, like me, I work on this movie I'm on it for 2 years or less, and I go on to another one. And now that's a totally different set of creativity. It's different problems to solve, different, you know, different technical problems to solve, different visual problems to solve. Mm-hmm. Reinventing yourself. You have to reinvent yourself kind of every time you do a movie. Mm-hmm. And the...
I was just going to say the whole idea you're talking about with live theater background that you both have, which I think is really fascinating, particularly for the sake of a documentary. But just when you think about filmmaking in general, you know, the theater is that thing where, I mean, actors talk about this all the time. Like when they go and did summer stock for the first time, the new actor swept the floor or, you know, did carpentry or, you know, everybody had to do every job, which fosters this kind of, but also there's this, you know, theater, it's a live performance, right? It's going to happen tonight and we've got to all make it. And that's no different than when you step on the floor the day you're shooting, right? It's like, it is just, you're going into war and it's going to happen, you know, and you have to deal with things as they come to you. And I think that's really interesting that both of you have that background in theater, because theater, I think, is very similar to filmmaking in terms of the community and needing to be on your toes. You can't be like, oh, wait a minute. No, can we think about this? There's no time for that, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, I think one big similarity between the two is just the need for prep and the need for planning. I say that obviously having a very truncated amount of prep for this film, but we maximized it as much as we could. And you know, in theater, you just rehearse and you rehearse and you rehearse. Because when you get out there, there is no second take. I mean, you'll get another night, but
right,
you can't go back and redo that line in front of a live audience.
Right. And it's so funny too, because you're saying, you know, oh yeah, prep is so important, but yet I had to do this without prep. I think people who really embrace prep when they're faced with, hey, you have no prep, then you're good, right? Because you've fostered those skills, you know, that are become just part of your DNA, right? As opposed to just somebody who's never prepared before. Like I remember hearing an interview with like Wolfgang Petersen one time, and you know, no shout out to Neverending Story and a lot of the great movies he made, but he'd be like, "I hate prep." And it's like, what? You make $100 million movies, man. Like, that's awful. I don't want. Yeah. I don't want to hear that. I don't.
Well,
yeah. Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say, there's two. You know, building back, sort of doubling back to what we both talked about. There's two things that really prepared us for being able to work fast as a cinematographer. You have to make it look amazing. You have to tell the story. You have to be great to work with. And the faster you can work, the better you are. And it's within reason, right? And we're not talking about breaking legs and knocking lights over, but you have to work fast because it's time and money. Mm-hmm. And theater and documentary verite both teach you how to think on your feet and move quickly. And if you lose some key element that you were expecting, you pivot. And the other thing is to be able to walk into a room and see the shot immediately or to watch the actors and then immediately know how the lens is going to be for that. Yeah. And then where the lighting lands.
Yeah. You have to be able to maximize your time. Like we did in our school section, there's a section of the film that takes place in the school. We had one day to shoot all of the school scenes. And towards the end of our day, the fire alarm went off in the school. So we all had to evacuate the school, all go outside. And I think, oh man, that was a packed day before the fire alarm. I think we might've been outside for close to 2 hours. So we lost about 2 hours of filming time. So rather than just standing around and waiting, Jeff and I were like, let's go sit in your car and let's just get ahead on our shot listing and on our planning and how we're going to tackle everything else. So, you know, you just have to understand that curveballs are going to be thrown your way and you've got to try to maximize that time or come up with something that's constructive and still moving you forward, even if you're halted in other ways.
Right. And I feel like there is that moment where, you know, you have the 12 shots and then you have a setback and all of a sudden it's like, okay, I have to do this in 6 shots. And sometimes that's better. because you're, you know, you go to the essentials, right? You're not allowed to sort of have your cake and eat it too. And I'm curious, I guess, when you were working with the actors, I mean, because you had some really terrific actors. I mean, Skylar Gisondo, who I have a weird connection to, actually, he was in one of my second short film, this is almost 10, 12 years ago, when he was in the Rob Zombie Halloween movie, when he was a little kid. And it's been so cool to watch him grow up, and because he's terrific in this movie, he's terrific in Booksmart. You know, what was it like working with Skylar? And also, I'm forgetting his name, but the great actor who plays Pete on Mad Men.
Vincent Carthesio.
Yeah, amazing. You guys had really great actors. I mean, and did you find yourselves needing to rehearse, or were they so good that you guys could just start rehearsing on film?
I don't know what Jeff's rehearsal process with them was ahead of time. His prep time was for working with the actors was almost as short as mine was. Mm. But they didn't really need a lot of rehearsal time. Obviously, right. We'd get in and we'd run the scene and we'd get into it. But they were consummate professionals. I remember, you know, Vincent in particular. Obviously, he's playing three different characters interacting with himself.
Yes.
Those sequences were particularly challenging because we were going in thinking, okay, how is he going to time himself? We had body doubles for moments when the camera wasn't moving. We could just have like a body, you know, a body in frame that he could play to, and they would read him back his lines. But he was so good about his timing, and it was kind of scary how precise he was with his timing. And if he knew he messed up his timing, he'd be like, all right, I'm going to go again. Because we had originally intended, we shot those with a motion control rig with the Milo.
Right.
And the original thought was, well, we'll try it with a click track, something that he can kind of time himself out to. I think we ended up just nixing the idea because he was so precise with his timing. It was so on point that it was incredibly efficient.
Yeah, it's like it's truly, you know, I think this is something I also love to talk about on this podcast is the relationship between performers and particularly cinematographers, because it is such an intimate but also physical relationship, because it is about the actor, you know, the proximity of the lens, the distance, how they're calibrating, you know, feeling the camera. And I mean, I guess talk a little bit about that in terms, because it seems like that to me is got to be so much fun, you know, when you're working with an actor that good, you know?
Yeah. So one of my favorite scenes to shoot was honestly one of the smallest setups we had. It was Sophia Hammond's character. She plays the daughter in the bathroom.
Oh, yes, looking at her phone. When she's crying. Mm-hmm. Yes.
She's processing, you know, the cyberbullying that she's just experienced after posting that photo. And it was just me, one light, her in a mirror in the bathroom. Then we had, you know, Video Village outside of the room, but it was just the two of us in the room, and we just let the camera roll, and we just kind of found, you know, we let her perform, and I just found my frame based on how she was feeling in that moment. I think it felt so incredibly authentic. I was like trying not to even breathe. I didn't want her to even feel my presence in the room. And that, you know, it's a one shot scene. We essentially go from, you know, an over the shoulder of her in the mirror to there's a mirror on her left, and we move over to that mirror, and that's really the whole scene. And there was such simplicity to it, but her performance just carries that scene so well. And I just was there just witnessing it. Mm-hmm. And that was a real treat.
And I think it's also a testament to the storytelling that you guys were both employing, which was so simple, I think is the hardest thing in the world to do, you know, is that you could have shown her, you know, kind of interacting with bullies or talking about it, but the privacy and the intimacy of and the awful intimacy of social bullying is that it's just her and that phone. It's you're so dislocated and disconnected, and yet it's so personal, and so it's so simple that you just, like you said, you just have the camera there, you know, reading what she's doing, and it's so powerful, you know. So I just think it's a real accomplishment.
That sort of leads back to the theater thing again, right?
Yeah.
It's like the ensemble thing, right? I feel like having been able to do some acting myself back in the theater days and a little bit in front of the camera, it gives me a place to understand how to respect and create that space for actors and performers in front of the camera, how to be in a way that gives the performer or the subject the safe space that they need to do their best work. My job is to create this visual thing, but it's also to create a safe space for actors or performers or interview subjects to do their best, most honest work.
And it feels like it's much harder with non-actors, you know, like when you're interviewing people. I mean, you had a couple of the interviewees who were sort of like, you know, I don't do this, I hate this. They were very, very, you know, and I feel like,
anxious.
Yeah, very anxious, which is, you know, which is a natural reaction, you know, for a lot of people. And so, you know, I think you know, John, do you have sort of little tricks or techniques? I mean, apart from sort of when you're doing documentary in the midst of action, where you're sort of supposed to be invisible, how do you deal with that when you are the only thing they have right there? You know, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's that's a tricky one, but I feel like when you're creating an interview setup, you want to make it as unimposing as possible. And I know that that's sort of how could you possibly make a six camera camera setup not imposing? But we made sure that there was airspace for the interview subjects to be in, and that they didn't have to duck under things or step on cables or have to be standing on cables when they were getting to where they were sitting, and that they were in a comfortable spot, and that the light wasn't too punishing, and that it just felt okay to sit there. And then I also wanted to make sure that when they walked onto the set that they felt my warmness. And and like, I always express, like, hi, I'm John. I'm the cinematographer. I'm here to make you look good and help tell your story, and just make that be as warm as I can. And to also be open to say, hey, if there's something that would make you more comfortable, let us know. Mm-hmm. And the same, you know, with Verite. I joke about this, but I'm 6'1" and I try to become invisible when I'm doing Verite, right? But part of it is there is a way that's sort of, you know, it's like using the force to sort of become as invisible as possible when you're doing Verite with the camera, in a way to how you move your body and where you stand and how you speak and where you look and what you do with the camera. And all of those things help you be less imposing, more accepting, more inviting, and more invisible to to someone that's letting you in to their world with a camera.
And so, just so for the audience who aren't as film geeks as we are, you know, the documentary is basically, you know, we're talking about aspect ratio, which the documentary is shot in 16:9, which for all intents and purposes is kind of the standard HD television format aspect ratio. And then you have the film portion of a shot in 2:3:5 anamorphic, almost, you know, imagine sort of a widescreen you know, format. And so what I love about it is that you have this, you know, you have one format that sort of fits the world that you're trying to represent, you know, this surveillance, your these interviews, this kind of corporate world, you know, a little bit more modern, almost contemporary in terms of being stripped down. And then you kind of move into this cinematic experience with a different aspect ratio. So it's such a really beautiful choice, I think, that both you guys. So I have to ask you, when did you two sort of speak or meet, or were you in silos? Did they, you know, No. Yeah. I'm curious.
Well, it's a funny story.
Yeah.
The most conversation I had with John while filming was him speaking to me through what he had already shot. I saw the cut and that was the most conversation I had with him. We actually didn't officially meet for the first time until Sundance.
Wow.
Until the film premiered at Sundance.
Wow.
That was the first time we actually met in person.
Wow. Which is kind of how it maybe should be, right? Because it's like John's doing his thing, you're doing your thing. You're obviously both servicing the story and the director. And then it's just sort of to see, and I think I heard either one or both of you say this in a previous interview, where things move so fast, you didn't really ever see the finished movie until Sundance, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's gotta be so kind of wonderful. I mean, obviously terrifying up until mm-hmm. it starts to go, but talk about that experience, what it was like to see it with an audience for the first time.
Yeah. Sorry, John, you go ahead.
I mean, it was spectacular. I had seen little hints here and there of Jonathan's work, and I was thrilled. I was just like, wow, this looks great. But it was not fully colored yet, and it wasn't finished, all the VFX. So it was just a hint as to what we were going to see. But the very first time we saw our work together mm-hmm. was sitting next to each other in the theater at the premiere at Sundance.
Wow.
And I mean, we had met the day before and immediately hit it off. And we're like, we connected and we're going to be friends for a long time. And I think
we hung out most of the festival.
Pretty much. Yeah. When we ran around and saw films together, we immediately hit it off, which is great. And it's great to have a friend and collaborator both. But we sat there anxiously, sort of having the same sort of, okay, here goes. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt was sitting next to us and watching it with us, you know, and so we all sort of had this moment of joy because he really liked it. And it was nice to sort of have someone to reflect off of that knows what to look for, as well as mm-hmm. the theater was full of a packed house.
It was packed.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's hard to describe the emotions.
Sure.
Because it was both thrilling and terrifying at the very same
time. Yeah. It feels, I guess the easiest, coming from a theater background, it feels like, you know, getting stage fright. You're just like, is this going to work? Is this going to play the way that we hoped that this would?
Right.
Now, obviously I had seen that rough cut, so I knew in theory how this should work, and it worked beautifully in that, but you just never really know until it's done. And so not having seen it before that and seeing it with a live audience, that was incredibly nerve-wracking, but it's playing and you're like, okay, I think this is working. And the audience starts reacting, you know, more than I could have imagined. And you're like, okay, I think this is good. And then we got a standing ovation at the end of the film. The audience response was just, it was just amazing. It was such a special moment. And I remember we were up they brought us up to the front of the theater, for a Q&A, the whole team. And, the questions that we were getting from the audience were so on the money. It was so clear that everyone in the audience was so deeply affected by this film. So that was a really special feeling. Okay. We did something important. This is going to have impact.
Yeah.
And that was always what Jeff and the team at Exposure always wanted this to be, was the starting point for a conversation. Mm-hmm. And actually, I should take a quick moment to plug the website. If you go to thesocialdilemma.com, mm-hmm. There's a bunch of resources on there of, you know, if you've seen the film and you're wanting to know what to do next, or how can you help, or what can you do, what can you implement into your own lives? There's a litany of resources there to kind of help you, you know, understand what to do after you've seen the film.
Thank you. Yeah. Follow them on social media. Just kidding. I love that card at the end of the film. And what you're talking about, this kind of emotional, physical reaction to it, I think is so important because A, it's what a great movie does, but B, what you like, the message that you guys are trying to, it's very easy, I feel like, to intellectualize questions like this, but the fact that everybody's saying, oh my God, you know, the anxiety, the disconnection, the dislocation that I feel, the frustration with my family being dislocated, my kids, my wife, my husband, it's so tangible and palpable. And you guys really, you know, bring it across in the movie. And I think kind of, it's interesting too to me because Jeff, for those who don't know, the director, Jeff is also, you know, very accomplished, you know, his first two films, which Chasing Ice and Chasing Coral, you know, or at least lauded films. Chasing Ice was called by Roger Ebert one of the greatest films on climate change ever. And I think what's interesting is he's now sounding the alarm on something like this, which is a different kind of crisis, existential crisis, you know, that we're dealing with. But at the end of it, you know, when they're asking people, are we going to be okay? Are we going to, and most people are sort of like, I hope so. I, you know, it's, and so I wanted to pose the sort of a closing question to both you guys, you know, because it's obviously it's apparent that social media was perhaps created not with the intention of, with diabolical intentions, you know, it's okay, well, this is, we're going to potentially improve life, or we're going to create a platform that we're not sure what's going to happen. But once it became apparent that by changing people's behavior and manipulating people and hypercharging it, you know, boosting the nicotine, they could make more money. And that's when things have started to go, you know, horribly wrong. But where do you guys feel like, you know, people sort of, where is the fault in sort of ourselves? That as it, you know, are we helpless or, you know, do we, you know, where is that balance? I mean, how do you guys come down on this after having such a deep dive into the heart of darkness?
Yeah, I guess for me, it's a tricky thing because as you said, it was the letting the genie out of the bottle. Mm-hmm. Most of these things, most of the ideas and the technology that was created with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. And there was just not a lot of thought given to how it would affect people. Mm-hmm. I feel like one of the concepts I came away from on this, and I know that Tristan, it's kind of one of his big things, is design ethics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that when you make a hammer, you make the best hammer that fits in your hand. It has the balance. It swings. It hits a nail. And to some extent, that hammer can be used for harm. But for the most part, it's a fairly simple problem you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to solve a psychological, when you're creating a psychological tool, essentially, which is designed to use technology to connect humans, mm-hmm. in a way that's never been done before, that's playing at such a extremely high level. Mm-hmm. And I think that there just wasn't a solid set of design ethics to really make sure that the technology that was being created couldn't be turned around against its own better intentions. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think also, as we've seen with all capitalistic endeavors, when you apply capitalism to it, all of a sudden you have adulterated it in an irreparable way. Mm-hmm. And when you are really only trying to do one thing, which is make money, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden the humanity leaves it.
Right.
And I think that's the it really switched to the, all this tech really switched to the dark side when they decided that they had to make a bunch of money from it, mm-hmm. and didn't have a solid ethical framework to make that switch.
Yeah. Well said. Well said.
I couldn't have said okay. it myself.
No,
he said
no.
It perfectly.
It's so complex. You know what I mean? It's just because it's like I think Tristan says, you know, I can call a car on my phone in 30 seconds, you know, but I can also destabilize Rwanda. I mean, it's insane. You know what I mean? It's really hard to comprehend. And I think anyway, it's such a thought provoking film, guys. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And I just wanted to end with sort of one last thing, you know, which I always like to ask the guests is, you know, for anyone starting out who, you know, young filmmakers, old filmmakers, people who want to do what you do, you know, what advice would you have for them?
I would say now is the golden age of technology and is the golden age of expression. There are so many ways that you can make a film with modest resources and get it out there, because there are way fewer gatekeepers and way more of ways to get an audience to see something. So really the hard part of it all is to say, what is the message you want to say? What do you want to say? How do you want to say it? That's the hardest part I find, mm-hmm. is what do you want to say? Because there's a million ways to say it now that weren't even around when Jonathan and I both started.
Yeah. The accessibility of getting into film is so much more prevalent now. like you said, there's so many ways to, you can pick, it's cliche to say, but you can pick up your iPhone mm-hmm. and go film. They even have lens adapters yeah. for iPhones. Now it's kind of mind blowing. I'd say in addition to just getting out there and filming, kind of to John's point, is finding your voice or finding what you respond to. And I think for me, that was found not only through, you know, experimentation on set, but also just through ingesting movies, just watching movies, good and bad. I think that there's just as much value in watching a film that you love as there is in watching a film that you hate. And just to say, you know, what is something I don't respond to? Maybe there's something that, and it doesn't even have to be a bad film necessarily. Maybe it's a film that is critically lauded and it's considered a classic, but it just doesn't respond. You don't respond to it in the same way, but you know, watching it and trying to pinpoint why don't you respond to it? Like, what is it about it that doesn't speak to you? And so I think there's a lot of value in just sitting back and being very in touch with the way that the movie is making you feel and why you're responding to certain things, and starting to kind of establish your voice through that, in addition to just getting out there and shooting.
Well said. Guys, this has been terrific. Thank you so much. You both have to come back whenever you have anything else to talk about, because it was really great.
That'd be a pleasure.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much.